Now an interview, which I'm sure will interest all commando comrades, but particularly those of the 1st Special Service Brigade, or later 1st Commando Brigade, as it became, commanded by Brigadier the Lord Lovett. Here he is being interviewed about his experiences of D-Day on the 6th of June 1944, preceded rather appropriately by the pipes.
Yes, we're going to unveil a plaque to the 1st Special Service Commander Brigade that sailed from Wasatch in the Hamble River on the 5th of June. And there is a pub called the Rising Sun, a Whitbread pub, who very kindly agreed for a plaque to be placed in the wall of their hotel to commemorate what I think was rather a historic occasion when the commandos sailed away in 22 landing craft to spearhead the landing on the beaches the following morning in Normandy.
Yes, you mentioned the 5th of June. You didn't mention the year, 1944. Of course, it was D-Day, 6th of June.
Right.
Yeah, the Rising Sun pub.
Wasatch.
Yeah, what was special about the Rising Sun, tell me?
Well, the Rising Sun was about the only building there at that time. It was a small backwater creek, but there is a little road that goes down to the pub, and the local citizens of Hampshire go and drink there still.
Did you tell me before you left for the beaches of Normandy, have a final drink at the Rising Sun?
No, there was nothing like that, I'm afraid, on that occasion. We were... In a camp in Southampton for 4 days, waiting for the weather to clear. We were locked up in a transit camp, no entry or exits allowed until the transport rolled in to take us down to Wasatch, where we embarked after about an hour and a half's wait. We sailed down into the Solent about 6 o'clock in the evening.
The tension in that 4 days before you sailed must have been almost unbearable, I should think, because you knew it was going to be a very crucial campaign.
Yes, it was pretty grim, but you feel the parcels in the post by that time. Your preparations are complete. You're in the hands of the Navy after that, and we had a very good team with us, so the flotilla of landing craft. We'd practiced for over a year with them.
Mm-hmm.
That is essential, I think, to know your sailor if you're a combined operations man.
How did you feel as you moved down the Solent through that vast armada of little ships and landing craft? It must have been very stirring for you.
Yeah, it was a great moment because I had a piper playing in the bows.
Bill Millen, I believe.
Bill Millen, who'll be there on Wednesday. And pipes sound well across the water, and the big ships that were waiting to come on after us were all the soldiers were on deck and cheered us to the echo as we passed down through about 7 miles of shipping.
Mm. I know you won't talk about your own part in the initial breakthrough, but those pipes of Bill Millen's meant a lot to the men of the 6th Airborne, didn't they, when you got to the Pegasus Bridge?
Yeah, that was a big moment when they were having a pretty rough time. They'd dropped the night before in the hours of darkness, and they'd been attacked again and again by Germans, lorry-borne infantry coming down from Caen, which was the nearest town, and they'd held out against very stiff opposition. And it was a good moment, I suppose, when we fought our way in from the shore, from the beach. We had to go 6 miles to reach them that morning.
What time did you actually arrive on the beach?
We landed at first light and got up to the bridges at 12 noon.
Were you the very first?
No, there was a brigade who was meant to clear the beaches of obstacles and wire, but they got into pretty bad trouble, and they were pinned down on the sand, and the commandos had to really blast their way through the Atlantic Wall. We were lucky in one sense, because the defenses had a system whereby they set the sea alight with petrol on the tide, but a French resistance movement man came and cut the cables, which was rather kind of him, or we'd have been set alight before we touched down on the beach.
Now, I gather you had to reach Pegasus Bridge at a particular time to meet up with the 6th Airborne, and you were late, weren't you?
I was 2 minutes late, but I can tell you now that the Navy were 2 minutes late in getting us ashore. So I kept my date.
Well, I think it's absolutely remarkable because you couldn't really have foreseen what was going to happen when you hit the beaches.
No, I think that was largely a good fortune, but I guaranteed to do it, and I had some very good troops, so I knew if they run all the way and fought well, they'd make it. We practiced pretty often in training against very stiff opposition, not live bullets, but almost everything else.
Mm-hmm. What was the importance of Pegasus Bridge, tell me?
The importance of Pegasus Bridge was to keep the keep two bridges open, one over the canal and the other one over the River Orne. They were both vital for communications to get our armor across. If the bridges had been blown, we'd have been pinned on the beaches, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And we also wanted to seize the lateral communications and get to the high ground, which was above the bridges. It said the bridges were naturally in a river valley. Both the River Orne and the Orne Canal ran parallel, side by side. They were about 500 yards apart. And we had to cross both of them to get on the high ground up above, which commanded a view of the beaches. And if the enemy had held the high ground, I think the battle might have easily gone the wrong way, because they could have shelled the beaches and nothing could have been brought ashore.
Now, I gather that, I don't know if it was the first night that you were set up there, your headquarters staff was set up trying to settle down for the night. There was a bit of a rude interruption, wasn't there?
Well, that went on really the whole time. And are you referring to the drop of the airborne landing brigade who came in and dropped a whole lot of things on our heads by mistake?
Well, I wasn't actually. What happened there?
Well, the air landing brigade came in after the two parachute brigades had dropped overnight the previous night. But on the evening of D-Day, the gliders came in. More gliders came in with reinforcements and also dropped a lot of packages to supplement the ammunition and heavy supplies that were still required to hold the bridgehead.
Mm-hmm.
A good deal of that stuff fell around, not always in the right place, and we had one or two big bumps in the night. We thought it were Germans landing, but there were only cases of ammunition and heavy mortars and what have you dropping from the sky on our heads.
Well, not a nice thing to get from your own side, really.
Well,
but
it was pretty hectic. First 24 hours, those were only minor incidents that I can remember in a pretty bloody day.
But didn't you have a problem from a sniper as well?
Well, snipers were present all the time. No, I don't think you could say one individual sniper. There was a good deal of bushwhacking in the first week before the Germans threw in their heavy counterattacks. Sniping was going on really all the time. There was sniping all the way in the advance to the bridges, sniping in the orchards where we dug in. We were continually sniped, and of course mortared throughout the night and day. The mortars were pretty unpleasant, hitting trees and bursting overhead.
Did you have any particular kind of tactic for dealing with that sort of sniping?
Yes, the only way to deal with a sniper is to go out and find him.
And you did that yourself, did you, at one stage? Or at least you led a group, I think, didn't you?
Well, I don't know that I did anything particular. We had a pretty tough 7 days. The first 7 days of the battle were touch and go, because although we'd fought through the West Wall, it took a long time to get anything ashore after us. We were on our own for 3 days across the river. And during that time, I think we beat off 7 attacks by German infantry supported by tanks.
Terrible, terrible times. Lord Lovett, we'll talk about the reunions that you have in just a moment, but I think it's fair to say that old soldiers never die.
Right.
There we are. that was Old Soldiers Never Die, especially for Lord Lovett, who's in the BBC studios in Inverness, and he's talking to us from those studios before going down to Southampton for a reunion, a D-Day reunion. Now, I understand there'll be nearly 100 more old soldiers, old commandos there this year than there were last year. That's extraordinary when your force was disbanded 34 years ago.
Well, I think the answer to that is that a good many people now have retired. They've reached 65 and beyond, and they have more leisure. At our annual reunion, we have about 600 men come into a very good evening in London, and alternate years, we go to Glasgow, and we coincide that with the football final between England and Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And the numbers there have ranged up to 670, and I think that happened this year. And I would like to say this in passing, that the commandos who I had the honor to command were all volunteers, and they were disbanded as soon as the war was over. So it's all the more impressive, I think, because there weren't so many of us, after all. In my brigade, there were 2,500 all ranks that landed on D-Day, and we had 978 casualties amongst those people.
Almost 50%.
Yes,
and I think more than 50% of the officers were killed or wounded, too.
Yes, the officers have had a worse time than the private soldiers.
Absolutely desperate, really. What about the difficulty for you of maintaining morale and momentum of the operation in such circumstances? Because it lasted something like 80-odd days, didn't it?
You're right, yes. We thought we'd be ashore for about 3 days, because we were treated as shock troops who bust through and knocked out the opposition, and then hopefully were withdrawn to rest or kit up again. But in the Battle of Normandy, we were 83 days in the line without relief, and that's quite a performance. Any young soldier listening to me right now should remember that you feel pretty fit and well for the first week or so, but 83 days in the line is quite an ordeal without taking your boots off.
So how did you keep your morale up, or the morale of the troops?
Well, I had really first-class men. There wasn't a weak link in the chain. There couldn't have been, because I was a casualty after 7 days, my brigade major after 4 days. I lost 3 commanding officers out of 5 in the first 2 days.
Was there any time when you thought your number was up?
No, you don't feel like that in fierce fighting. It's rather like playing a game of football.
In the battle itself, something was interesting. You went in wearing green berets and not the regulation steel helmets, didn't you? Now, why was that?
Correct. Well, we had to move very fast, and we didn't like being cluttered up with heavy equipment. I would say that wearing a tin hat on your head is rather like walking about with a piano on your head. You can't think, and you certainly can't move at speed.
Occasionally, though, it must afford protection, but I suppose you're willing to sacrifice that for the speed. Huh?
Well, that's a curious thing, you know. In all my experience in fighting, I only saw about one man whose life would have been saved by a tin hat. If you're shot through the head by a sniper, a tin hat doesn't help and stand any protection anyway.
Mm.
People had head wounds, but they weren't fatally wounded by not having tin hats on.
Looking back, is there any way in which you would like to have changed either the tactics or the broader strategy of that Normandy invasion?
No, I don't think I could possibly really give an opinion on that. It was way over my head. I think we did more than was expected of us. I think the it was a sound scheme to have experienced terrible stick at Dieppe and then landing on an empty beach and getting the heavy stuff ashore, lorries and equipment with Mulberry Harbour. I think that was a brilliant stroke of, you could almost call it genius. We'd have never landed in a defended port, which was considered essential at one stage in the planning.
Mm. Why was it at one stage considered essential, tell me?
Well, because you had to drive your heavy lorries ashore,
yeah.
And you had to get your tanks ashore on what should have been a hard standing on a dock, and boats to come ashore unloading equipment with cranes and things.
Obviously an awful lot of improvisation, a lot of fast thinking had to be done. Tell me, though, about the lighter moments, if there were any, during that 80-odd days in which you were almost under siege, I suppose.
No, I don't think there were any light moments on that particular operation. It was, we lost quite a lot of people at sea, which meant we were undermanned throughout. We couldn't get reinforcements up to us because of the trouble on the beaches. The beaches were more or less sealed off, you see, after we passed through them.
Mm-hmm.
And lighter moments, I can't think of any.
Just the end, I suppose.
Yes, one had one or two laughs in the sense that one had to laugh when the piper's lost his pipes with a direct hit with a mortar shell. I suppose that was quite funny.
How did he improvise? Whistle through his fingers after that?
No, he had nothing to play on thereafter. He was without any musical instrument for a long time.
Hmm. Finally, do you think that we harp back perhaps too much on those wartime days, or perhaps not enough?
Well, it's very hard to say. I personally remember them as vividly as though they'd happened yesterday, and certain things were tragic, certain things were triumphant, but the great thing is the spirit, I think, of comradeship that exists between soldiers who fought together. You never forget a face if you're alongside him in action, and I think it's a very... It makes you straighten your back to remember those things. I think it's rather dull for civilians to hear people talking about their war experiences. Most of the people who had a rough time very seldom speak about it. There are one or two blowhards, and you regard them with a certain amount of suspicion. But I think that spirit of comradeship lives on. It's something which is so badly needed, belonging somewhere today. And soldiers do belong to each other. Especially commandos, because they were volunteers, and the very fact they disappeared in 1945 makes them stick together closer than limpets now.
I don't think that civilians mind being reminded of it, actually.
I think the younger generation are rather interested to know, I think, probably now, which they weren't 20 years ago. They'd heard enough about it from day to day, and probably their mothers said, don't talk about the war, it's a terrible time, it went on for years, and we were blitzed and had a worse time than the army, and that's probably true about people living in southern towns in England. So I think in a way the wheel has gone round in a circle in some senses, and young soldiers can certainly profit from what they hear from old sweats like myself, because the first time you go into action, you're bound to make mistakes. And yet at the end of my soldiering, the commandos that I had the honor to command had a complete contempt for the Germans. Well, we started off being in holy fear of them until we got to know how to handle them.
Well, Brigadier Lord Lovett, it's been marvellous talking to you. Thank you for joining us from Inverness, and I wish you a joyful reunion near Southampton at the Rising Sun on Wednesday.
Thank you very much.